This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we all have regrets in life. Our guest says that's not a bad thing. We'll talk about the upside to regret and what we can learn from it. Now, data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau shows that the percentage of men in the U.S. labor force has been steadily declining for years. Over the same span, the percentage of men who report being a stay-at-home parent has been on the rise. That group represents still a relatively small fraction of the overall population, but the trends are showing no signs of slowing down. In opposite-sex couples, it has gone along with a rise in women as main household breadwinners. Our next guest has researched these trends in recent years to find out what kind of impact they're having on parents and families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are any of the men in your life exiting the workforce to be stay-at-home dads or caregivers for other family members? Are you in a household where the woman is the main breadwinner, the main money bringer? If you're a guy who has made that decision to be a stay-at-home dad or had that decision put upon you, love to hear from you as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Noelle Chesley is an associate professor and sociology department chair at UW-Milwaukee. Noelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to join in and talk about this a little bit more.
Well, now, historically, household roles, I think, have been kind of gendered, certain responsibilities split between men and women. What have been some of the downsides of those traditionally, I guess, defined gender roles?
Well, I mean, the downsides are definitely a lack of flexibility, right? When you've got people who specialize in either taking care of the kids or in working a job to earn the family income, if either one of those areas gets disrupted and a person can't do them for one reason or another, it makes it very difficult for the family to respond at that point.
Now, I mentioned some national stats out there showing a steady increase in the number of men taking on those household caregiving roles. There are different ways to measure it, of course. What are you seeing out there as you've looked at research over the past decade or two?
Right. Yeah, you're right. There's people do argue a little bit about the numbers and the trends and sort of how to define this. Mm-hmm. I think what's really important for your listeners to understand is that staying at home without any employment is not very common for either men or women. I mean, in today's world, among couples and people who have children, it's much more common for either both members of a couple to be employed, for single parents to be employed. And we do still have families where there's a full-time at-home caregiver. It's much more likely to be a woman than it is to be a man. But there have been more men entering that role. This is something that we really started to talk about and see a little bit more right after the Great Recession. So right around 2010, I think this was a pretty hot topic. And it sounds like it's reviving a little bit now with some things that are out in the news.
I want to talk about the cultural response to this. In my youth, there was a movie called Mr. Mom that was all about the hilarity that ensues when the dad
yes.
is the household caregiver. Is there still sort of that, I don't know, discomfort or weirdness that people feel about it?
I think so. And I will tell you, I've interviewed families where there's a stay-at-home parent who is a man in the family. And many men that I have talked to hate Mr. Mom. They hate the movie. They hate the name. So definitely don't like that. Feel like it's a little degrading. And yeah, I think there still is some stigma around switching up these roles, actually both for the women who become primary earners for their families and for the men that take on that primary caregiving role.
Can you talk about the economic factors that are leading to some people doing this? I did it myself for a couple of few years there where I was working part-time from home and being Mr. Mom, I guess, for the little kids in the house. What is driving people to do that? Again, not the dominant majority, but what is leading to some of those trends?
Yes, I think that in many ways you could view any kind of a move, especially for men, I think, to become full-time caregivers as symptomatic of really a sort of a lack of good, affordable childcare options, and also a commentary on demanding jobs. So I think what a lot of families find in general is that it's tough to find good childcare. It costs a lot. And so that definitely is a consideration that many families have to take have to think more about and strategize a little bit about how they want to meet their caregiving needs. And then there just is a problem with jobs being pretty demanding. And so it can be difficult to substitute for the kind of family support you need, especially if both members of a couple have really demanding jobs. So you'll sometimes see, especially in you forwarded me a Bloomberg piece, you know, there's discussions about people who have two really demanding jobs. And once kids are in the picture, even with, say, a great nanny, they just can't manage that.
We're talking to Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor and Sociology Department Chair at UW-Milwaukee, looking at caregiving men. Trends show men taking on caregiving roles more at home, maybe being, it's rare, full-time stay-at-home dad or part-time, part stay-at-home dad. Women more commonly becoming the breadwinners. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, and also love to hear your experiences wherever you are on these trends yourself, your own family. If you are a dad who's taken on more caregiving roles, love to hear from you. What kind of response do you get? Do you get called Mr. Mom? Do you hate it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, we focused on part one of what we're talking about here, the men maybe being more likely to be caregivers. Also, the trends I mentioned earlier on, Noelle, women being more likely in a two-parent household to be the primary breadwinner, when in the past, usually if a woman was the main breadwinner, statistically it was a single-parent family. What are you seeing in that?
Yeah, well, here I think part of what we're seeing with women and their earning potential is a result of more and more women investing in education. So I can't remember exactly when this happened, but a few years ago, some of your listeners might have remembered reading in the paper something that we now had more women entering college, for example, than men. And that was really positioning a lot more women for these more demanding and often higher paid jobs. And I think that's happened at exactly the time that we've sort of been building on a longer standing trend of declining manufacturing jobs, the wages at some of those jobs that were traditionally done by a lot of men, and especially a lot of men who didn't have more formal education after high school. Wages and opportunities in those sectors of the economy have gotten a lot tougher. So I think there's been, it's a pretty complex mix of a lot of different things going on in the economy, but certainly we're seeing that more and more women are going to be better positioned for higher earning jobs. And as those women marry and, start families, it's going to change the calculus a little bit about how to meet these different needs, about who should work, who should really stay home and take care of kids.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, John.
I was listening earlier, and you were talking about men staying home. Well, my wife and I had an interesting relationship in that I worked nights and she worked days. So I would stay home with the kids and take care of them during the day. And then while they were sleeping, she would be there to take care of them.
Now, John, that sounds hard to me. I mean, working night shift is tough as it is. What was it like being a child care provider on top of that?
It was very tiring.
I bet.
I didn't get much sleep for about 3 years.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Noelle, sounds like you want to jump in.
Yeah. No, I love that John added that to the conversation because it's a good reminder about some of the different strategies that families do come up with to handle, this sort of conundrum about how to earn money and how to take care of especially small kids. And what he describes is definitely something that we study and that gets talked about among work and family researchers such as myself, this idea of families having different shifts or trying to manage shifts so that they can always have that 24-hour parental care is something that families do engage in. A lot of families, like John mentioned, find it to be difficult. It can be stressful, and it's actually, it can also be associated with higher rates of divorce, with some of the research that we've seen. Sounds like John was successful in managing that in his own life, but it comes with its own challenges too. He mentioned being really exhausted, and I'm sure he and his wife didn't get to see each other there for very much for a while.
John, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This is a fun thing to recall for me because I worked at a daycare center in Seattle in 1987. So I saw this trend years ago that the dads would drop the kids off. They'd pay $3,000 a month. They were very wealthy, and they would I would take care of their kids during the day. But I knew men in Portland, Oregon, when I lived there in 1886, who were lawyers, and they would run their law office out of the house, and they would stay home and take care of the kids. I applaud it because it's very intentional parenting. It's very intentional family planning. I really like that idea.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Some experience from the 80s there, Noelle.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I mean, one of the great things about some jobs is that it is possible to combine them with childcare during the day. Although I think, especially having just gone through the pandemic, there are parents out there who would talk about the struggles with that. And I'm also just thinking about that commercial, or maybe it was a, I think it's the commercial where the little kid comes in and is interrupting his dad on the Zoom call. A little more recently, but not without its challenges to try to do all that out of the house.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to UW-Milwaukee sociology professor Noelle Chesley about a rise in stay-at-home dads and female household breadwinners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your family? How have you juggled things to make things work with childcare and the employment world? If you are a dad who has taken on most or all of the daytime or nighttime childcare role, love to hear your experience, the reactions you get maybe from friends and family. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor and Sociology Department Chair at UW-Milwaukee. With us today, looking at a growing trend of men leaving the workforce to be stay-at-home dads or part-time working and stay-at-home dads, and women serving as household breadwinners more often. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. Karen joins us now in Monona. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm driving. I apologize. When I had my third child, when we had our third child, and at the age that he was two, I had to divorce his father because I was the main breadwinner doing the child, about to do the child care. I was teaching at the time, and what happened was that was what I did. I continued doing child care until the kids were gone and then found another job. I turned into an apartment or a property manager, but since I was late into the career doing that, I still, in my 70s, have to work to make up for the lack of Social Security, et cetera, that allows me now to retire.
Karen, thanks for the call. Karen, bring up an important experience. I had the kids after divorce, single parenting and navigating the world of work. Noelle, we're talking about, what about when which parent is the only parent?
Yeah, actually what Karen describes is pretty common for a lot of women. You could also almost think of it as the caregiving penalty because for scholars who study especially poverty at the end of life, one of the reasons we see so many women struggling financially is because of a lot of the time that they either took away from employment completely to engage and care for their families, or because they had to take that more flexible, less well-paying job to sort of accommodate those responsibilities. So I think her story really illustrates that broader pattern that we see oftentimes in the population.
Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go to Alberto in Milwaukee. Alberto, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was listening to you guys talking about this, and not even the expert here has talked about love and attachment. The attachment the kids get from the parents during those years, how important it is. The same importance the attachment of the kid to the mother's breast milking. No drinking formula. The love and the whole is this. The conversation until now has been very transactional, very, very much about money and talking about breadwinner, which I was saying to the person that took the phone up. The breadwinner is a phrase from the 50s that shouldn't be used anymore.
Alberto, thanks a lot for the call. And actually, honestly, I've been saying breadwinner. I don't like that phrase either that much. I just don't have a better shorthand. But Alberto's point about the attachment and a lot of dads, I appreciated having that opportunity when my kids were littler. It isn't just about the money, Noelle.
Absolutely. Yes, I can definitely talk about that. Thank you so much for sort of turning the conversation in that direction, Alberto. And also on the breadwinner thing, I completely agree. We could just say primary earner,
yeah,
or, you know, larger earner or something like that. But one of the things I thought I could mention that I actually discovered in my own investigations of families who are taking this on is that one of the men who took on the role of being a more involved, more primary caregiver to their children oftentimes found that to be really transformational for them. And it's exactly what Alberto's talking about. I mean, they came to value the work that they were doing in the home, their relationships with their children really deepened in a way that, men would often talk about it in this very kind of transformational way. So I don't think we want to completely think about it as like, the work-family equation and how much does childcare cost and all those other things, even though those do weigh into family decision-making.
Thanks a lot for the call, Alberto. We'll go to Tony now with us in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, this is Tony. I did want to chime in that I was a full-time stay-at-home dad. Actually, still am, I consider myself. But I started back in 2003 when our second daughter was 6 months old. We also had a two-year-old at the time. We actually had options for childcare, but really, my wife and I wanted to do the parenting, the majority of it, at least ourselves. So that was probably the prime factor. My wife had a successful career in real estate. So that was I was an engineer. So her opportunities to bring the family income was much greater than mine. And that turned out to be a great decision. But that was kind of the main thing. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, the hardest thing to deal with was the generation of men older than me. They could really not understand that I would actually give up my career to do this and stay at home. The guys that were my age kind of thought more that, that this, I was retired. They would call me the stay at home mom and all that. They were more jealous, but I found it hard to deal with the generation a little bit older because they just could not understand me giving up my career. So that was the challenges and the enjoyment I had with staying at home with my kids.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Tony. Yeah, definitely. I think some generational attitude changes Tony is reflecting there.
Yeah. I love Tony's story. It sounds a lot like many of the families that I talk to. I mean, different in the details, but just some real central themes. You know, I think for families that have two professional parents. So it sounds like he said he was trained as an engineer and his wife had a job that was also, you know, potentially higher earning. What he described is really typical. I mean, this idea that the parents really value this idea of parental care and they sort of make the decision to have one person stay home to sort of uphold those values. I will say that there are some real different experiences for families that are not quite in those economic circumstances. So it can feel like less of a choice there for those families.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tony. Gretchen is with us now, also in Milwaukee. Gretchen, hi.
Hi, I'm Gretchen.
What did you want to tell us about Gretchen?
So I'm a teacher at Milwaukee Public Schools, and my husband is a full-time stay-at-home dad, and he is just like absolutely rocking it. But you know, when he goes out and about, he'll take the kids to the zoo or he'll take the kids to the park. And he always gets comments from a lot of like probably more so older women he says the most. And, you know, they'll say like, oh, looks like, you know, you've got your hands full. It looks like mommy's day off, or it looks like you're babysitting today. And it just drives him totally nuts. Because, you know, this is his everyday. And typically when I have the kids, I'm the one with my hands full. So it's just kind of unfortunate that people, you know, feel like they have the right to make those comments. So it's just kind of too bad.
Interesting, Gretchen. So we heard about the older men from our last caller. Now the older women, too, not quite getting it, Noelle.
Yeah, I think both of those stories together do really illustrate kind of the lag in attitudes in the broader society and sort of the realities of what families are actually doing in their everyday lives.
Gretchen, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute, Noelle, we can't predict the future, but what kind of trends, what kind of things are you watching for when it comes to who provides the caregiving in our households?
I certainly think that families, given the situation that we're in now with the potential for all sorts of disruptions in both employment and the rise of caregiving, I think families are going to have to be really, really flexible in how they deal with this. And more men are going to be pitching in and taking care of both their aging relatives and their young kids. And people are probably going to have to take turns and do different shifts and figure out all sorts of ways to try to manage this moving forward.
Noelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep, thank you.
That's Noelle Chesley, associate professor in the sociology department at UW-Milwaukee, also chair of that department, with us today looking at a small but growing trend of men leaving the workforce to be caregivers at home, women serving as the primary earner in their households. Still time for you to share your story with us, how you've managed these things, the caregiving roles in particular. Let us know your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, homelessness isn't just a big city problem. Find out how rural communities in Wisconsin are dealing with the housing shortages and homelessness in their area. And you can let us know what is going on in your own community. Share your experience if you work on homelessness issues, say, or you see it going on in your small town or rural area. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can call in tomorrow during the show. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. You probably racked up at least a few regrets in your life. They might be small things, like wishing you left earlier when you're running late for something. Or they could be bigger things, like wishing you had the courage to ask someone out, or that you chose a different career. Our next guest says those regrets are a core part of what makes us human. He says if we understand regret better, we can actually use it to our advantage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, if you're willing to share, do you have a regret that's been hard for you to let go of? Or have you been able to take a regret and learn from it for the next time? Have you learned things from your regrets over time? How have they changed the way you act now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Pink is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you lay this out right off the bat in your book. A lot of people love the concept of no regrets. Some of us even get it tattooed on ourselves. Why does this no regret idea become so widespread?
Well, I think it's because we're a little bit over-indexed on positivity. We think that we need to be positive all the time. We think that we should be looking forward all the time, that we should never look back, that when we experience a negative emotion, or particularly a negative emotion like regret, we should brush it off, think positive, and move on. And the trouble with that philosophy, that no regrets philosophy, is that it runs against 50 years of science, and it's a terrible blueprint for living.
Why? Why is that a terrible blueprint for living?
Well, because regrets serve a function. Here's the thing. Regret is one of our most ubiquitous emotions. It is one of the most common emotions human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion human beings have. There's 50 years of evidence showing that the only people who truly don't have regrets, right, who actually are true to this no regrets philosophy are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed enough, people with certain kinds of brain lesions and neurodegenerative disorders, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And, you know, I don't like experiencing regret. Nobody does. So there's this puzzle about why is something so unpleasant, so widespread? And the reason is it's useful if we treat it right. And the problem is we haven't been taught how to treat it right. We think of it as something to ignore. When we can't ignore our regrets, we end up wallowing them. What we should be doing is confronting our regrets, thinking about them, using them as engines of progress.
All right. How do we do that? I look back at some of my life. I regret A, I probably don't want to think about it. As you say, B, if I start thinking about it, I wallow in it. How do I steer that better course?
We have a lot of evidence on how to do that more effectively. It begins with how we think about ourselves and our regret. When we talk to ourselves in the face of missteps and screw-ups, we are brutal. Our self-talk is vicious and cruel, and the solution to that is stop doing that. Instead, practice something called self-compassion. Self-compassion is treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, recognizing that your regrets are part of the human condition. You're actually not that special. If you have a regret about kindness or lack of boldness, it's very, very common. And also our mistakes are a moment in time, not the full measure of our life. And so once we treat ourselves with self-compassion, we can begin to talk about our regret, make sense of our regret, and systematically extract a lesson from it that we can apply next time.
Talking to Daniel Pink about his new book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you regret and that you're willing to share? Do you feel like you wallow in it? Do you try to forget about it? Or have you learned from it? Do you have questions for our guest about this, the science of regret? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, you've done these massive surveys, first in the United States, then a worldwide one looking at regret. What are some of the most common big regrets that people express in these surveys?
Well, what I found and actually look at, so thank you for mentioning that. So I did one big giant public opinion poll of the U.S. population that showed that when you look at sort of the main areas of people's lives, people regret a lot of different kinds of stuff. They have regrets about careers. They have regrets about education. They have regrets about health. But then I also did something called the World Regret Survey, where I just collected regrets a lot. We now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. And what I found there, when you actually go beyond the domains of life, and I read through the first 15,000 of these, is that around the world, over and over again, people seem to share the same four regrets. Over and over again, they express the same four regrets. They have less to do with the part of life you're in, career, education, whatever, and more to do with, I think, some fundamental human longings and aspirations.
What are those main longings and aspirations that that will lead us into this path of regret?
Well, I'll go through them very quickly. Foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who have regrets about saving too little, spending too much, about not taking care of their health, about not working hard enough in school. Again, small decisions early that add up to calamitous consequences later. Second category, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. Again, this spans the domains of life. You mentioned one at the top of the show, Rob. Well, a lot of people regret not asking somebody out on a date. But these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret not starting a business, people who regret not speaking up. They're at a moment in their life when they can play it safe or take the chance. They don't take the chance, not always, but often they regret it. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. These are regrets about bullying, marital infidelity, other kinds of transgressions. And finally, the fourth category, connection regrets. If only I'd reached out. They're relationships, it's regrets about relationships that have come apart or should have been intact or were intact and are no longer intact. And somebody wants to reach out, but they say it's going to be awkward. The other side's not going to care. And so they don't do it and it drifts apart further. And with remarkable regularity, people express these same four regrets.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
I have a question. What can we do, or what are some mechanisms when we find ourselves loathing, maybe in some of these regretful type thoughts? Any help for your viewers or listeners, rather? Thanks.
Sure. Sure, Jake. So as I was mentioning earlier, one of the best things you can do is to stop. The first thing is to stop that march toward rumination. And the way to do that is to treat yourself with the same generosity and kindness and empathy you would treat somebody else. If a friend of you came to you and said, "Oh, Jake, I made this mistake," you typically wouldn't say, "You idiot, what's wrong with you? You're the worst person in the world." But that's how we talk to ourselves. And as I said before, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness. Recognize that these mistakes, these regrets are part of the human condition. The second thing you can do, and it's really important, is to talk about it or write about the regret. When we talk about a regret or write about it, we unburden ourselves. What's more, we do something profoundly important for negative emotions. We take this abstraction, this blobby negative feeling, convert it to words, and then that's far less fearsome. These concrete words are less fearsome than the abstract emotion. And finally, we have to draw a lesson from it. We have to be explicitly draw a lesson from it. And a good way to do that is to get some removed from it and ask yourself, you know, what would I tell my best friend to do in this situation? Or what would I want to have done 10 years from now? And so when we reframe inward and treat ourselves with kindness, when we express outward and make sense of it, and then when we move forward by drawing a lesson from it, we can begin to develop a habit of using our regrets as an engine for progress. And when we do that, there is a massive amount of evidence that it helps us in profoundly important ways. I mean, even in more reductively narrow ways, it helps us become better negotiators. It helps us become better problem solvers. It helps us become better parents. The problem is no one has taught us how to do that. And it's a very simple process.
Thanks for that question, Jake. We're talking to author Daniel Pink. His new book is called The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to live your life with no regrets? How is that working for you? Or have you made a point of learning from regrets, things that you see as mistakes in your past, and trying to get it better the next time around? Or do you have questions about how all this regret stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with author Daniel Pink about his latest book, The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You could join in to share regrets you've had, how you've overcome them or dealt with them, or your questions about regret. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel on Facebook writes, "We cannot change the past, but we can certainly learn from it. Holding on to regrets or resentments destroys our ability to enjoy today." What do you think? Share your thoughts. Dan, something that struck me in your book, you share a lot of regrets that people shared in your surveys. One story that really stuck with me when it comes to Joel's comment about learning from our regrets, a woman who talked about regretting that she hadn't listened to her grandparents more, enjoyed time spent with them until it was too late, they'd passed away. She took that, though, and said, "Okay, as my parents age, I'm going to make sure to listen, and I'm going to make sure to take that time." Can you talk about that as an example of how we can use our regret?
Sure. It's a great story. This is a woman named Abby who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she was growing up, her grandparents, who lived in Indiana, would come and visit for a couple of months a year to, you know, because Arizona winters are far more pleasant than Indiana winters. And when she was a kid, she hated it. She resented them being there. And then they passed away and she realized she had screwed up. And what she missed was the connection, the stories. And what she decided to do is, again, this is a great example. She could ignore it, say, "No regrets, no regrets. Look positive, be positive, look forward," right? Or she could say, "Oh my God, I'm a horrible human being. This is the worst thing that anybody's ever done." Instead, she said, "Oh, I feel bad." That negative feeling is a signal. It's a signal about what I value, and it's a signal about what I should do next. And so she has begun systematically collecting the stories of her parents, who I think are in their early 70s at this point, making an effort to literally to collect their stories and assemble their stories. And so she has that sense of meaning. She has that sense of purpose. And it's a good example of the best way to deal with regrets, which is to use them as information, as data, as signals.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Adams. Randy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Randy?
Well, I just think another word for regret is forgiveness. You have to learn to forgive yourself, because most people that have regrets, it's because it's their something that they have done and that they should have done. And if they learn to forgive themselves, they can work towards, like, say you said something bad to a friend or something and you regret it, and then it just eats at you and eats at you. You got to forgive yourself for saying it, and then maybe you can go to your friend and apologize.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dan, what do you think about the forgiveness part of this?
I think Randy makes a great point. I mean, what she is calling forgiveness is an aspect of self-compassion, which is, you know, treat yourself as generously as you would treat somebody else. You know, the other thing that she that Randy mentions is a pretty interesting distinction in the architecture of regret, which is regrets of action and regrets of inaction. Regrets about something that I did and regrets about something that I didn't do. So for things like, let's say you said something terrible to your friend, to use Randy's example, that's a regret of action. You can actually sometimes make repairs on those. You can apologize. You can make amends. You can make restitution. What's interesting is that what lives with people far longer than regrets of action are regrets of inaction. As we age, regrets of inaction, regrets about what we didn't do, outnumber regrets of action by about 2-1.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Pink about his book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan, a thing that really strikes me here is a lot of the regrets, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of, we become science fiction authors and craft the alternate history. What if I had gone to school or hadn't gone to school or married this person instead of that person or whatever, and our alternate history is way better than the one we're really living? How do we get over that one?
Well, it's an interesting question, because sometimes our alternate history is way better than the one we're living in now. But I think what really eats at people is not knowing what that alternate history was, and also not delivering at the moment. So, for instance, I have a lot of people who regret not asking, as we talked earlier, not asking somebody out on a date or something like that. But very few of them say, oh, if I had asked him out on a date, we would be married and have 3 kids and, you know, living, you know, a beautiful life in Milwaukee. They're not saying that. What's gnawing at them is, in that particular case, is not stepping up at the moment of being at a juncture in their lives and having a chance to do something bold and shrinking from that chance. Now, you're right that the way we think about regret is to conjure these alternative histories. But what seems to bug people about a lot of these inaction regrets is not so much the outcome, but the decision itself.
Now, one thing about your 4 main buckets of regret, the foundation one, where I wish I'd taken better care of myself, planned for my financial future, and so on, it seems sometimes to contrast with the boldness one. I wish I'd taken that chance. I wish I'd done this thing on the spur of the moment. How do we reconcile those two? The I wish I'd taken more risks versus I wish I'd hedged my bets better.
Yeah, that's a good question. The things that people did, I actually think there's actually a very close affinity between having a stable foundation and having a psychologically rich life. I think that having a stable foundation allows you to take sensible choices. The foundation regrets that people were talking about were not, you know, when they spent money, they were spending money on frivolities. They weren't saying, oh, I tried to start a business and it failed, and therefore I'm in bad financial shape. I don't think I had anybody who said that. I had people who said, I earned an okay income, but I spent it going out to restaurants and buying cars and stuff that I didn't need. So the foundation regrets were very rarely a trade-off with boldness. They were something different. They were about kind of investments in oneself. And so people were not, it's not like people were being overly risky in compromising their foundation. They were being actually stupid in many cases. And when you have at least a stable foundation, that gives you a little bit more of the temerity to take that trip, to try something more more adventurous.
We heard from Dean on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, regrets equal fear of the past, worry equals fear of the future. Live in the now, Dean concludes. Easier said than done for me, Dan. I don't know. Is that normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not terrible advice, but I think that one of the things that you see in some of the research on the temporal side of human development and human flourishing is that what we want is in some ways an integration of the past, present, and future. What we want is we want the past to inform our present, and we want the present to guide our future. There is a very interesting personality psychologist at Northwestern University in fairly nearby Evanston, Illinois, and he says that people see their lives in terms of narratives, and there are two kinds of narratives that he says. Dan McAdams is the guy's name. He says there are contamination narratives where things go from good to bad, and there are redemption narratives where things go from bad to good. And humans seem to flourish when they see their lives as redemption narratives. And the downside of living in the present only is that it's not a narrative. It is simply, you know, processing this particular moment and not seeing how it integrates into one's past, present, and future. And we know healthy flourishing depends, at least in part, on seeing your life in this narrative terms of making progress, of getting better, of moving from bad to good.
Dan, you talk at the end of your book about, you know, this isn't just research you've done for research's sake. It has started to seep into your life. How has your long look at regret changed your own personal behavior?
Well, on these connection regrets, I have to say it's changed it significantly. So what happens with these connection regrets is that people have these relationships, often friendships, usually not, I'm not talking about romantic relationships mostly. Think about a friendship, and the friendship comes apart. And usually they come apart in profoundly undramatic ways. They drift apart. And one side wants to reach out and they say, nope, it's going to be awkward if I reach out, and the other side's not going to care. So it drifts apart more and it feels more awkward, and they think the other side's not going to care less. And they're wrong. There's a pile of evidence showing that that reaching out is far less awkward than you think, and the other side almost always welcomes it. And so for me, it's like if I'm at a juncture where I'm saying, should I reach out or should I not reach out? Being at that juncture has answered my question. I mean, always, you know, reach out. If you're at that juncture, reach out. And that's changed me, because I'm not somebody who is like super social or super, you know, really good at reaching out. But this changed my view on it, because I had those misguided views of awkwardness and the suspicion that the other side wouldn't care. And I was flatly wrong.
Well, now, apart from reaching out, Dan, in our last minute or so, leave us with a bit of advice on how to start using regret in a happier way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would suggest with people is this. This week, have a conversation with someone about your regret. People want to talk about this. Tell somebody around a dinner table, in your office, hey, here's a regret that I have. Here's what I've learned from it. And here's what I'm going to do about it going forward. That simple process. Here's my regret. Here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do about it. That will trigger one of the richer conversations that you will have this year. I can almost guarantee it. It's a topic people want to talk about. It's a topic that we've made taboo, but it's a topic that can yield very powerful lessons in what we value and how we should lead a meaningful life.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Pink. He's the author of a bunch of books. He was with us today to talk about his latest. It's called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can find a link to information about the book at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you have thoughts on regret, maybe an experience to share yourself, there's still time. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.